Now, oh, now it's going.
All right, back to Masechet Tani. I want to do a few quippy portions over a few pages in the Gemara today and share a little bit of what I just left off on last time, that is, as we were talking about all this establishing the culture of learning Torah and being careful to not sin so that we allow the world to become the fruitful, plentiful, wonderful world it should be, and not withhold from it the rain of, in this case, the rain of Torah that nourishes the world. The establishment of that rabbinic culture, the rabbinic houses of learning, and the character of what it means to be a rabbi and what it means to be a sage and what it means to be a Jew, I was talking about how that's both for men of that time and that women in our time have really been part of the house of study as of late. And I was telling you about this book by Alana Blumberg, and she is reflecting on her life of commitment to Torah learning, and I wanted to start a little bit with some of her reflection as we think about what the sages are saying and realize that they're not really being that inclusive of many women, though there are some women in the Gemara. We've actually looked at some women and their presence in the Gemara and their erudition of halakha and their voice as being sometimes strong answers to rabbinic assertions, or their presence in the Beit Midrash, like last year's in Yoma, we had a woman come in and turn the tables upside down. Said, if you're not fair to these people, then don't sit down. Learn Torah until you need to in order to put the tables right and get back to it. So anyway, this is a woman who had the experience of what some of us around the room have either invested in or have experienced ourselves, and that is the day school world of modernity that treated both men and women equally, co-equal partners in the endeavors of Torah study, and how it inspired her. And I think you'll just find this yet another layer of why it is we're looking at the inside of the rabbinic world over here and where it's led us. Think about what kind of reader she's becoming. Her passion for Torah in and of itself, but also a way of thinking about life. So this book is called Houses of Study. She's finding her place in Houses of Study and thinking about her past. It says, when in third grade we receive our first Chumashim, the slim navy volumes of Genesis, our parents get together in secret before the ceremony to make us bookmarks. I think it is my mother's idea. They have taken two blue lucite sheets, cut them to the size of bookmarks, and between the sheets inserted the cutout shape of a tree. The trunk of the tree is made from beautiful white paper. You can see its grains through the blue transparency, and the tree's crown is made of a shiny gold material like the crown of the Torah scroll in synagogue, rather than the crown of a holy organic tree. On one side of the white trunk, vertically, each set of parents has written in thin black marker their child's Hebrew name, Ilana. On the other side, they have printed my mother in her fine, clear Hebrew print, Eitz Chaim Hi. It's a tree of life. Torah, I learn over the years, is a tree. It's water. It is a plaything. It is a well. It is a marriage gift. It is a flame, it is a fruit, and it is all these things to me. I learned to read it. I learned to read its interpreters, beginning with the medieval commentary of Rashi. Rashi, we learn as children, did not have enough paper or ink. Thus, his comments are as spare as his materials were scarce. He writes only answers to the questions that haunt his commentary in their absence. Often, to allude to the fact that there's a question, though he has not specified its nature, he will simply say, this verse cries out, interpret me. Ein hamikra hazeh omer ela darsheni. Over the years that I study Torah, I learned to turn to Rashi only when I can foretell what will merit his attention. In this way, I start to become an expert on the verses myself. I listen for the mute call of the silences or seeming aberrations of the text. And Cain said to his brother Hevel, and it came to pass when they were in the field, and Cain arose against Hevel, his brother, and killed him, even as a child, I can guess where Rashi will stop. What will trouble him? Though I cannot guess his answer. Rashi will ask, what is it that Cain said? And Cain said to his brother Hevel, and it came to pass, something crucial is missing. I know whatever he said had to have been hostile or provoking. Something that could lead to murder, because that is the consequence of the speech. Rashi may give me an answer, but it is my job first to understand the question. So, I think in the sense of sharing some beautiful sense that, you know, here was a bat mitzvah girl on her way to understanding more deeply Torah and trying to find the right places for women to fit in and the beginnings of a Beit Midrash that would understand this modern young woman from a modern Orthodox place she's coming from, who reads Austin and Eliot and Dickinson and Wolfe, and also all the passages of Gemara that we're studying in the Beit Midrash and the like, that she's finding her place in especially in our time, and can find her place. And she wants to go deeper, and her parents have fears for her, and there are those who say she does have a place and those who say she doesn't have a place, of course, because she's willing to be part of this people and she's willing to be in this conversation. And I just think it's important, by way of this Masechta, as I told you, we're reading it with this, you know, volume. This is the first time I'm really reading a volume of the feminist commentary on the Babylonian Talmud alongside the other commentaries that we're bringing to the table. That it's interesting to note just where the women's voices do come in and where the women's presence makes itself known on the pages of the Gemara that we have. She, who was talking about Rashi and all the wonder of Rashi and the kind of dialogue she had with Rashi, in one case, in what we're going to begin to learn today, will fill in a very interesting story that maybe we'll get into the depths of, maybe we won't get so deep into the depths of, but that also deals with just the place of women within the Gemara itself. And I thought a nice juxtaposition.
The way you read it from the book, it's interesting what she's presenting to second-guess the interpreter, the Rashi, not the text, the Rashi. What was his approach? What was on his mind?
Well, she's not second-guessing Rashi as much as she's trying to understand the question behind the commentary.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Which is interesting by itself.
Yeah, sure.
Why is he addressing this and not that?
Well, that was Nachama Leibowitz, yeah, who we learned last year. Big question to all her students. Makoshi, mm-hmm. What is Rashi's question?
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So look at the Gemara with me. This, you know, I think you'll see the connection, or you'll, you know, let me push you towards making the connection here. Sometimes Rashi deals with the reality of conversations between Cain and Abel, for instance, that we just heard her talk about, this woman bringing to the fore this deep question about morality and what does lead to corruption and even murder in society, and that's where Rashi really gives us a sense of what really needs to be understood in that conversation, that opening conversation of the Bible. What does Rashi help us understand here? What does Tosafot help us understand here? And just where, again, does a woman fit into the picture? Is just kind of why I thought, again, we should start with that other passage in that book. So look on the right-hand side. It's a teaching of Rav Ami on 8A2. Chet Aleph. Okay. Amar Rabbi Ami. On the right-hand column of the English, 8A2. Yeah? Yesh Tacharan? Okay. Amar Rav Ami. Rav Ami says, Ein Geshemim Yorodin Eila Bishvil Balei Amana. Rain falls only for the sake of people who are trustworthy in their business dealings. So the issues I brought up aside, here we're back to the righteous kind of behavior we need for the rain to fall, and the sins that we want to avoid in order to continue along precipitation in its course. And we'll get to the other issue. Shenemar, there's a proof text that's brought, because you have to be a person honest in your business dealings. Emet me'eretz titzmach v'tzedek mishamayim nishkaf. Truth will sprout from the earth. Charity will appear from heaven. And therefore, the truth that comes from the earth will ultimately lead to what? The tzedek min ha-shamayim. And what is tzedek min ha-shamayim then?
Rain.
So tzedakah from heaven really is defined as rain. What a beautiful kind of notion, right? That the rainfall, the pitter-patter, the storms, the precipitation, all charity from heaven. All tzedakah from heaven. Beautiful. Another teaching of Rav Ami. Oh, what?
But you would think it would be the other way around, because the rain would come first and then the sprouting would be. But they do the sprouting before the peering.
Ah, but the emet that sprouts from the earth, which is a different kind of sprouting, then begets the tzedakah from Shemayim, which is the rain. And then you get the sprouting of the grain, which really jives with what we learned in Deuteronomy, right? Because if you continue to keep the commandments and do my will, I will look upon you as you are righteous citizens of the world. Then I will send the rains in their seasons, and then you'll eat. Right? So it's with the Deuteronomic kind of theology in mind that passage makes a lot of sense to us.
Truth of the fact of the earth means us.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Not from the actual, from the ground.
Correct. The emet here is the business practices, the amana, the people who are doing good business with one another. Amana is an interesting word, by the way. Amana is a reference to a contractual arrangement between Nehemiah and a certain group of people in the book of Ezra, Nehemiah. And it's used in the Bible without the vav in that vein. So it's kind of got this religious sense and contractual sense of an agreement to it. And that's where from it just has been applied to regular business dealings here. And so it's not amuna with vav, as in religious faith. It's amana with
contractual
business among people. Which is interesting, because remember, if we didn't have the points, if we didn't have the actual vowels and we were just looking at it, Jewish eyes might look at Aleph, Mem, Nun, He, and even without the vav, you might be just so used to seeing that those letters together in combination, you might pronounce it Amuna and just think it was Vav Chaser, meaning it lacks a vav. But in this case, they read it strongly, that there's ethics going on below, people, rain comes from on high, and then you eat your portion. Okay, but Rav Ami kind of continues on the theme. It says in the idiomatic translation, continues on this theme. Okay. What kind of theme is this? Va'ama Rav Ami. Bo ore, come and see kama gidolim ba'alei amona. Ah, so now the contractual kind of business reality that amana was talking about before is now going to be about sexual fidelity. Right? This is going to be kind of a weird story in very short form, but we're going to expand on it to understand what the stories really say. Minayin. How do I derive that this is now really talking about faith in God according to the translation of the Art Scroll, but I will add that it's real sexual fidelity and ethical behavior when it comes to sexual relations and promises in the landscape of Kiddushi, in the area of marital promises. Minayin, mechulda uvor. It's we can derive that the notion of the greatness of the people who have emuna comes from the incident of the weasel in the pit. Okay? Now, so, if you didn't know anything and you didn't have a footnote down below,
yeah,
if you already read it,
I would have thought it was a weasel in the pit.
Okay, you would have thought what? Huldah What does the word Hulda, first and foremost, really remind you of right away?
The prophetess
Hulda. Remember that there is a prophetess in the Tanakh named Hulda. And what is Hulda most related to in the stories of the Tanakh? This is not a test, nor a pop quiz. Right? She's most related to King Josiah's Deuteronomic reforms. When you see her name, you're saying the righteousness of Israel, the righteousness of a woman prophet in Israel. Okay? So that immediately kind of comes to mind. Except that Hulda is also some type of rodent or weasel-like animal that in tradition, and just to prepare here, because there's this kind of anchored definition of this word that we need to know, it's a pit as well. It's not just the weasel and the rat. It is a certain type of pit, and pit has, I think, a somewhat of a negative connotation in English. Let's say there's a, what's another good word for pit? A dugout area, a ditch of sorts, a purposed ditch in this case, a purposed pit in this case, where immediately the ancient mind would say, it's a story about the weasel and the pit, because the Hulda is the weasel and the vor is the pit, but the Hulda is also a word that had been used for a dugout area, not in the typical cemetery, wherein, should there have been a miscarriage and there was a stillborn, because we didn't put that in the cemetery proper, it was in this pit, in this ditch of an area, that those remains would be cast. And in general, you could imagine the world's a little bit more wild at that time, right? And I'll just preface this by saying there are some cultures where instead of putting your tooth under your pillow and you get a dollar or two, right, that you throw teeth over the roof and you hope rats come and take the teeth away, right? There are a lot of different tooth traditions about what we do when we dispose of the parts of our body that are no longer relevant to our own, that in this tradition, when the stillborn, when the remains are stolen away by those animals that are oftentimes found around either the trash heaps over here or more in these areas where remains are cast, and take them, like when animals eat their own young sometimes, right? That this is a kind of superstitious way of casting out that stillborn so that the possibility for life in the community and for the woman for a next healthy pregnancy could occur.
I think stillborns are buried at cemeteries.
Today, we make different calls, and especially depending on the when of a stillborn. And we're very sensitive to these matters. But in the ancient world, for sure, it was not the case. And ears hearing a story, as we've tried to deepen our understandings of different vocabulary going on within a text and what it might mean to a reader in that milieu, you have to understand that this story has all those overtones. That familiarity with the Tanakh and the woman prophetess, that familiarity with the fact that this word has got a dual meaning of prophetess and weasel, of sorts. But by the way, the chulda is not exactly the weasel, but it probably is another type of rodent. It's very difficult for us to understand exactly zoologically which animal that is, but it's some type of rodent that is larger.
It says it's a marten, and it's much cuter, so I'm going with marten.
Okay. Yeah, a marten is much cuter. Is that what the Steinsaltz, I didn't look it up in
there. Yeah, he said it's related to the weasel, but it's not, he said the weasel is exclusively carnivorous and wouldn't drag leavened bread, as is mentioned in Pesachim.
Right.
He says the marten, which belongs to the same family, is found in Israel, and they'd be the holder.
Okay, so that's most likely the rodent. Steinsaltz has done the zoological work. He's the one who's done the most up to this date. And is there any mention of this other tradition I'm talking about?
They tell a whole story about the...
We're going to get to that story.
Yeah, no, he didn't
But not anything about that cultural, social history of... Okay, so that's the larger background, that third part that I'm talking about the notion that there's some type of death involved, of the animal world and death colliding, of potential for life residing in whatever these prophecies were that had become part of the mythology of how to deal with this reality, and the physical reality of all that kind of coming together in just this one little sentence in the Gemara, right?
And do we think that the word is the same because the marten comes into the pit and takes...
Yes, exactly.
And I'm imagining them, not burying or shrouding this human remains so that they're open to the animals that come for them.
Correct. Yeah. And I think, again, because symbolically in that world, that was the right way to move life into life zone and move death into death zone and save animal world versus human world. The literacy that we gain from having that kind of now lexicon says about the story that if you're not from that time period, though, like we might not have known that if we didn't do the work to understand this, we might not understand the depth and the import and the impact of this story. Rashi knows that, and I want to now get to this notion of kind of bringing up the Rashi. Rashi knows that for his audience, they may not have that kind of literacy. He's not going to bank on what we know about social history. He's going to bring another story that this seems to refer to, which is the story that I think Jay said Steinsaltz mentions, in addition to what our footnote mentions. And so let's just read the footnote aloud. Interesting story. 21. A reference to the following incident. A girl, while on her way home, fell into a pit. A boy came by and promised to rescue her on condition that she marry him. The girl consented, and they made the pit and a passing weasel witnesses to their agreement. Okay? Just think about the idea here, right? On a legal basis, why do they need two witnesses? Because we need two witnesses. We're kind of in halachic reality here, but who are the two witnesses in this case? The weasel and the pit. So the weasel, and this, keep in mind, just for a moment over here, is going to give us some pause to think about what kind of story
is
Rashi
like
telling.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
This is a little crazy like that, right? I thought it might be a little reminiscent of some of this kind of different literature. Different literature than we're normally encountering. And we should notice that, because it is different Rashi. This is a different kind of Rashi, it's a different kind of Tosafot, it's a different kind of inclusion.
By the way, the Hebrew story is a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, hold on one second. So, the girl consented, and they made the pit and a passing weasel witnesses to their argument, to their agreement. They went their separate ways. The girl kept her word, but the boy married another woman. He had two sons from her. this other woman. The first was killed by a weasel. The second fell into a pit and died.
Poetic justice.
Poetic justice. Mida, can I get Mida? Poetic justice. When his wife inquired of her husband why such unusual misfortune had befallen them, he remembered his earlier promise and related the incident to his wife. She told him that he ought to marry the girl as he had promised. He divorced his wife and married the girl. So now that's one version of the story. Ron says the Hebrew is different. Where are you reading the Hebrew from?
It's in the body of the translation.
It's in the body.
It's not a note.
It's in the body of the translation, but is it the actual bolded translation?
Yeah, it's part of the bolded translation. It's the story says it, Masek Achaya, and the only difference is that it doesn't save the girl. It's just the story that somebody...
Okay, good. So there you go. So you now read the Hebrew. And this is how the story goes. A boy promises a girl that they will get married. Now, what did not happen thus far in this version? She didn't fall into the pit. Go ahead. Two witnesses affirmed that pledge. One was a pit nearby, and the other a passing weasel, or a passing marten. The boy transgressed his word, married another woman. Two babies are born, one falls into a pit and dies. And another was bitten by the rodent and died. Why did the children die such strange deaths? He described the promise he made. And from that we learn
that this is kal vachomer parallel to more complicated things or situations.
So one needs to be good to
the mashal.
One needs to be true to his word as pledge. This is the amanah. This is the
bottom line.
When you make a pledge, you make a pledge. This is the tale that's used. Except that over here, what happened with the woman, she says, divorce me, go marry the other. She is the one who sets him straight. The Bavli includes the Huldah prophetess voice saying, you shall do the right thing. Despite the fact that there's divorce involved, despite the fact that there was death involved, we get to the notion that the end of this is, in the words of the woman, the right thing to do. Not just simply a rabbinically mood of kal vachomer, all the more so, a person who gives his word about such and such. So this is a very important notion to recognize. Just one more piece and then tell me. No, tell me now.
So basically, this is the black cat. If you see a black cat, it's like, oh, be careful. So the Huldah is the black cat of the story. You know?
In a certain sense, but over here, the Huldah is turned around to be the voice that really commands you to be ethical.
You know, this idea of just punishment is coming through, and it's such a kind of a literal misfortune. It wasn't just that they had, you know, an ill child or, you know, or bad luck or something. It's a pit and it's a weasel that, you know, corresponds with it. I just am uncomfortable with the rain and, you know, being a reward Because I think once you go down these punishments and rewards, you end up with illness being a punishment for something that somebody does. It's a biblical thinking that I try and stay away from.
Yeah, I don't know that it's only biblical, though. It's biblical. It's rabbinic. It's Middle Ages. It's into modernity. There's theological positioning that allows a person to make good use of such a theology without 100% having to agree with it. I would say that sometimes the theologies stand for us as being instructional, but not determinative. So if I...
it's like allegorical and it has a fantasy.
But just about applied theology, Bobby.
It's kind of charming in its own way.
If I take the ultimate notion of sin punishment theology, and I sometimes imagine myself paying a price for sins that I've committed, I have to say now and then that thought goes through my mind as being a somewhat healthy thought when it comes to my own life. But were I to think of that vis-a-vis your life directly, I would say that it's over gvul, that I've crossed the boundary. However, where I also think that there's a gray line, a gray area in that, is that if I am to search myself deeply in terms of making a cheshbon about society and what it is we're missing the mark about, and then receiving what I would call punishment in kind of more theoretical ways, right? Not that it's a zap of the lightning from heaven, but that we're not achieving some greater goal or good. We're not achieving the kind of vision of history that we imagined in the realm of, you know, the greatness of what our age could mean. And I liken it to sin. Then I'm willing to live with sin in a very religious way versus just write off sin as being something of yesteryear. And I think a little bit more sin for me, a little bit more sin in our world is not a bad thing. But I fully agree with you that the ultimate end of that theology as one measure for measure type of punishment theology is not a healthy way to imagine the world of illness or to imagine the way of someone else's suffering, or sometimes even our own.
I'm kind of still hung up on whether or not this contract is valid. This woman is not able to be considered as entering into a contract because of the coercion.
So let's talk about what this whole picture really provides in terms of any kind of valid sense of either obligation, contractual arrangement. Is it a folk tale, first of all, or is it not? And that's why we have such characters within it. Oftentimes there are animals, inanimate objects become animate within the parameters, even right. This is considered to be folk literature oftentimes in from this age. Two, it's interesting to note, this is what I was going to say about Rashi, in addition just in general to respond to your question. Rashi oftentimes will be very sensible and not tell us a tale that seemingly makes for fictitious realities and or fantastical realities coming true in the landscape of rabbinic literature. This is a really interesting Rashi story. The man, the woman, the weasel, the pit. Interesting tale from Rashi, right? You could do a whole manuscript
with Disney
lecture on this. I spent part of the week poring over different versions, and whether or not there's a version with people who were witnesses was one of my questions. It seemed so invalid. You're talking about Kiddushin, and they're using it as such an example for the righteousness they want in the world. I would imagine there would be a more realistic halachic picture that Rashi might bring to explain exactly who was the boar, who was the chulda. Maybe they were stand-ins for people, like, we call him the pit.
To Barry's point, though, I'd be more troubled if the contract were being enforced against her. So she she consented, whether she consented or not, he breached the promise, she didn't.
Yeah, for sure, but I'm just saying if there was no contract, then everything that flows down from a contract is not valid.
Yeah, we're at, I like the point a lot because it's true. It really is. He's learning the lesson. Back to, again, another comment that you had offered,
well,
Barry, that here are Chachamim really not living up to their part.
But look at his poor wife. I mean, his wife is suffering for...
No doubt. No doubt. But look at what that message could be in terms of how your actions and decisions really impact others versus he's such a... And we take it all out on this one guy. In other words, the literature is created for us to get that meta message. And I think that this literature is standing here to give us the meta message that despite our questions about the validity, here we have a scenario where there is really what to learn. And there's a deep message in this, despite the fact that we have questions about how a pit and a rodent become witnesses to a kedushin and an arrangement that should have been maintained. And the true lesson that she teaches us is the one that's important. And the voice that is brought out is because of one of Rashi's fantastic ways of filling in the picture.
So it's interesting that there are two involved. The third party, which is the second wife, or the wife, is punished, and then he go back to the younger one, or to the other that had no kids. So he's the winner all around. So
no, he's a loser. He lost his... To make him sympathetic, you can say, you know what? I made her promise me, but I'm not going to enforce that promise. She was in a pit. I'm going to go marry. I'll let her. I'm going to marry this other woman and have two children. He suffers in a big way.
No, but his legal wife really suffered.
He loses two children and his wife.
I feel we're being a little bit too literal about this in some ways. I think it is a fairy tale. I don't think there's coercion. I personally picture it more like a cute little story if he's saying, I'll take you out and we'll fall in love and all. I think it's about unintended consequences and collateral damage and how essential it is that we really try to recognize that our own behavior has ramifications beyond our own lives and the way we perceive what we've done. And communally, it's funny, I was thinking before when you were talking that I have less of a problem with this notion of sin theology when it refers to the community at large. In other words, we all as a community have to be better or we'll be punished as a result, as opposed to an individual who has something horrible happen to them and we can't stand thinking that, oh, you deserved it. But then again, there are big communal things that happen when tsunami comes and wipes out hundreds of thousands of people. That, of course, is talk about over your full. I mean, that's going too far. But I think we just as a society, as you said before, it was funny the way you phrased it, you said you have no problem with a little more sin in society, and what you meant was not more sin, but more of a concept of sin, and that we take sin seriously.
Right.
And I think that's what I'm getting from the story. I'm not worried about coercion, because I really don't think that's the purpose of the story. But where did Rashi get the story? Where does that come from?
Yeah,
you
so
it looks
like it was a well-known story.
Well, it was probably a well-known folk tale, if we are thinking in terms of the, ontology of it.
But a local.
The Rashi has it. Pseudo Rashi has it, which is another set of commentaries that we have. The Tosafot has it.
Yeah, but does it go back further, or is it a local? French fairy tale. I mean,
No, most likely it's exported from. A lot of those are exported from rabbinical oral culture, so we wouldn't imagine that it was
not in Midrash.
We wouldn't imagine it's local to Rashi's Europe. We would imagine that it's more brought from the world of the Beit Midrash to explain what was going on in the Bavli manuscript itself.
Is there a similar story like that in other cultures?
I have not checked.
One more answer.
It seems just reading the lesson according to Rabbi Ami, as the lesson that he's deriving. Apparently, it is all about, at least the way I see it here, it's all about whether those two witnesses are valid,
mm-hmm.
and they're obviously not valid witnesses,
mm-hmm.
but they're saying, but what he's saying is if the consequences, the translation here is, from the incident of the weasel in the pit, if one who trusts in a weasel in the pit has his trust honored to such an extent, then, in other words, if trusting in a weasel in a pit is honored to such an extent that all these consequences fell out of it, then all the more so that it comes from God.
Mm.
So the story itself is more about if so much credence or trust is given to a weasel in a pit as witnesses, which are obviously probably to everyone in the story,
not human.
It's just ridiculous. But if so much store is put on that, then how much the more so would you have to trust God?
Just in terms of one thing is that I do think you might be pointing to the ultimate goal, which is to be Bale Amanah, right? Don't read Amanah simply as ethical in business. Read it as having deep faith in God and don't put your trust in anything but God. So that's where I think you're on track with getting us to the ultimate message of the divine, the trust in the divine.
I'm going to cast it a little bit more darkly because really after you describe what these words mean and everything, there's a lot of death in this little story. Both of those words stand for a pit where a sadly unborn child is going to be devoured, you know, and taken
mm-hmm.
off.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the two witnesses, and then there are two children that are lost in those with those same two words. So the consequences of this is really quite dire and sad, even though it sounds, you know, a little fairy tale like and fable like.
Yep.
You know, the meaning or the connotations of these words, both of them, are very kind of what's the word? I don't know. It's like very base and very, you know, kind of brutal.
Right? Fairy tales are very grim, no pun intended.
They are.
they're not. Yeah. When I said fairy tale, I didn't mean Charlie Happy Go Lucky, but
no,
I think you're right. It's an incredibly dark story.
Right, especially around France with Rashi, and a lot of fairy tales come from that time.
Yeah, definitely.
And have been cleaned up over the
and
years.
And perhaps, for that reason, there is some propensity for Rashi to share a certain number of stories within his commentary, which is, again, a different lecture for a different time. There are 9 or 10 famous Rashi stories within the commentary that's on that. Maybe one time, if we're interested, I'll pull out for us and we'll take a look on a week, maybe, if the stories of Rashi are another good summer Beit Midrash topic. Actually, that would be a lot of fun, too. So let me end this part of the Gemara discussion with this. Because we just ended on such a dark note, I'll turn to the end of the feminist commentary on the Masechta.
Yeah, this is a Me Too moment. Here he's at the top, and she's in the pit, and he uses all of his leverage and power to extract an agreement that has sexual,
and then
right, that has a sexual culmination.
So listen to how it's said here. And then we'll push on to another little piece. In the Tosfot story, the well or cistern or pit, which could be very well be a well, that is, not just a regular pit, but the symbol for woman and drinking water and Torah coming into the world, it oftentimes denotes sexual relations. The well itself is a good sign for mating and marriage. The pit in that way does not represent death, but represents the possibilities, the fertility, the fruitfulness.
That's
the stretch.
On the other hand, the role of the chulda is more incidental and forced. She appears all of a sudden in the middle of the story so that she could also participate in the man's punishment. The epilogue found in the Tosfot version could be viewed as a happy end. When the man's wife finds out that their children are dying because her husband had failed to keep an oath, she requests a divorce and sends him to fulfill his vow to his betrothed. This, however, a happy end only from the point of view of the man as the story's hero. The narrative viewed in this way is about a man who fails to fulfill his side in the contract, and when he realizes how detrimental this failure is to him, he repents and is redeemed. Feminists have observed, however, that this story features two women who could also be conceived of as heroines.
Yeah, I think only two women.
And in order for the man to learn his lesson, both must suffer. The first woman suffers because he fails to keep his oath and marries another, leaving her in the lurch. When he returns to her after many years, she is no longer young, and certainly sorrow must have taken its toll. According to the Aruch version of the story, another version that we didn't discuss, she actually goes mad. The second woman, whom he marries, bears him children in ignorance, and they die because of her husband's sin. When she encourages him to divorce her and marry his betrothed, she is not redeemed, but rather remains a bereaved mother. Thus, Alexander sums up the situation like this. This is the article called The Weasel in the Well. The two female protagonists are portrayed as dominant, active, strong characters. They manipulate his life, and they generate the solution to the problem the story presents. The power of the story, and perhaps the reason it has endured through many generations, is in its underlying theme, which is that the broken oath is irredeemable. The solution presented by the plot of recovering the original oath is only a surface solution. The corrective marriage will not make the dead children live or repair the broken marriage. Thus, it seems that Pseudo-Rashi was right in leaving the story open-ended. So, interesting tales on page 8 of Tani. Let's go forward. Turn to page 8A3, just on this notion of suffering. You know, the question of whether there has to be some suffering in life to be a heroine, to be a hero, to be pursuing the righteousness that we know is really important for the world. Well, this is the reality of humanity. Bobby said it plainly. We're not talking tzedek, we're talking now about suffering. Yisurin.
No, but we started about tzedek.
He's talking about amanah.
No,
the proof text. The proof text was tzedek.
And then it comes immediately to this story.
Yeah. I would only say that in response to that, the notion of tzedek then is setting right. Tzedek, tzedek, tir dof. You will always be pursuing tzedek, and there will be foibles. There will be hardships. There will be suffering. There will be injustice. So that then that word helps me understand the place of all this within the context of society, in the context of interpersonal relations, in the context of the marriage relationship. So I think that there is tzedek there. It's just that we haven't found it yet. We have to be rodef acharav, that we have to chase it. Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. I'm on the bottom of the left-hand column just to read two sentences. See where Yoshua ben Levi is on 8A3? Amar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Kol hasameach b'yisurin sheba'in alav, whoever joyfully bears the suffering that befalls him, mevi yeshua lola, brings deliverance to the world. Shenemar, as it said, bahem olam v'nivasheya, through them the world is saved. Now, I don't think this is outright saying, if you are, you know, deathly ill, start enjoying that suffering joyful. Start enjoying it. Be in great joy. Now, some extremist might think this is saying joyfully bear any suffering that is coming your way. I think it's more existential. And that is, we have what to bear in this world. In order for tzedek to increase, I'll turn it back to tzedek, since that was the verse, that was the proof text that Ron just reminded us of. But I was going to think in more in general, amanah, that we who have to strive to be moral creatures, let ethical principles guide our lives, constantly struggle. We who will suffer physically and will have to use that suffering to imagine ourselves fixing right, to be fixers, to bring ultimate righteousness to the world, then that I think is, quote unquote, the religious joy that's at the core of any of this kind of presentation of suffering that's in the Gemara. As we work towards really understanding what it means that there is such a thing as brachot, we'll say, yisurin shel ahava, if you look through your own misdeeds and you account them not for the sins that you've done, right? Meaning, I know I've done everything as righteously as I possibly can, and I'm still suffering. And it will say that, well, then obviously these are yisurin shel ahava. These are sufferings of love from heaven, from God. I think, again, we have to define that in a way that simply doesn't take it at totally face value, because I can't imagine there wasn't space, even if some people understood it simply as simple sense of the words, that really they were sufferings of love.
That came to be much more Christian than Jewish.
Well, it's very, very Talmudic. Could it be borrowed from early, you know, let's say proto-Christian and then Christian ideas that work their way more deeply into the very, very roots of Christianity that are developing in the times of the rabbis? We could do that. We could make the comparisons for sure to sufferings and the sufferings of love that are in Christian sources. But we can't deny, and this is why I wanted to point out the sentence, we can't deny that they're in Brachot. We can't deny that they're in Tanit. That this notion that there are sufferings that we have to go through in order to strengthen our resolve. And I would say it's strengthening our resolve to be in that partnership with God.
But this isn't personal. This is through them the world is saved.
That's why I'm saying that it is about, see, the world in general versus our personal servitude. And that, I think, makes it distinct from a typical Christian at that time, especially, notion that the suffering servant is the one who then is doing this service necessary to receive his salvation.
Right.
It's not necessarily the world, because one who's doing it Christologically, ultimately it's about serving in order to... I mean, you could say if it's getting back to Jesus, that's true, as a fundamental idea.
That's it.
I agree. Here we have, though, the everyday human being, the sage, in addition to the everyday Am Yisrael, Nick, who's out there, going through and having to make sense of why it is that I'm suffering, because there is a certain amount of redemption that I could possibly bring in partnership with God to the world if I accept the fact that this is part and parcel of what I will experience in the landscape of the living.
I'm not buying it. I think at the individual level, I buy absolutely. The idea that my suffering is bringing redemption to the whole world, I think, is not really the way.
It could be based on Amatzil Nefesh Achat Matzil Olam Emloo. You saved one soul, you saved the whole world.
Yeah, but
so that could be a continuation of the negative.
Saving, it's not,
yeah,
suffering.
This is not suffering for the world. No, that's saving. That's being
that's
active and going out and
active
doing
active
something.
Action.
Just, you know, to help
no.
someone. Anyway, I'm
look, you can get out of suffering. You
no, well,
from this, from
it's for a minute. I kind of knew that the one sentence would make us separate a little bit. It's here. And the notion that we do have to find some way to either, you know, fully agree, you could fully agree with this, you could fully reject this. This is one limud of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi.
Yes.
So we also have the hermeneutic with and around this limud to both accept it and to reject it, which is what the great Talmudic culture allows for.
The whole thing is still wrestling with the age-old, you know, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yep.
And
which is,
of course,
a perennial problem.
And the people who are writing this, no doubt, consider themselves good people. And they're suffering.
Unless they define someone unless they define someone as not up to snuff, or as being boorish, or as being an ignoramus, or so a lot of times, yes, they're encouraging us to refine our ways.
But they're also saying that just essentially you're reading this goes beyond just saying just because you're suffering doesn't mean that you've done something wrong. As a matter of fact, they take it further. It is because of people like you who are suffering that the world is getting better. There's no.
That's the Hava Amina.
Yeah, but there's no explanation of that.
That's the Hava Amina. Right. That is, you could take it, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi's Memra, at the time you need it. Let's say it's only for the time you need it. That's one key on your ring now. Theologically, you could be there. For you. You know, we've said before, whether it's through the stories that are told about it, or as we reasserted today, you can't say it about anybody else's suffering. Don't tell somebody else. Best advice in the world, right? Don't tell somebody else that sufferings are sent by God out of love.
Let me just reassociate it, because this is the first time I've seen this. But let's contrast this with Job. There's not a hint that I remember of anything in Job about Job's suffering doing something for the world, despite the fact that he was a righteous man.
And he continued to
keep
talking.
I don't remember a shred. Did I miss it?
Well, I would... Looking at it through the lens of, like, let's say, Robert Alter, and the narrative formation of Job, there's a passage about, where were you when I created the world, right? So when God says that, the question really is, and you can argue either way, is God saying what Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi is saying? That in order for the world to exist the way it does, Job, I need you to go through this suffering. Now, he's not saying, hey, Job, accept it in joy. I would say to you that that phrase does not exist within Job itself. But if I'm to read a little bit of the narrative arc of what God translates to Job as a way to understand
I
the suffering
that,
within the book.
So I took that part to just mean how insignificant one human is relative to God's eternal...
Yeah. I think that's the Peshat read.
Right.
But that's not an alter narrative arc kind of read of what this is relating to intertextually with all that literature that's swirling around the rabbi's table. Remember, if I accept, and I've kind of brought this picture into focus before, if I accept that the Tanakh is being canonized at the same time that rabbinic culture is crystallizing, then intertextually I have to read a little bit more in tune with the suffering of Job and the suffering of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi and the suffering that's going on in Masechet Brachot. Because the canon that includes Eov, that includes Job, who we don't know is even a Jew, right, it really stands as a suffering text within the suffering texts that I have to contend with in rabbinic culture.
I think there's another layer there. I think there's a hint into a very interesting metaphysical theory that's not new. That as much evil there is in the world, then it's balanced by as much good. So it's the system, the world, the universe is composed of two forces that balance each other at any given moment. Evil and good at the same time. Yisurim comes from evil. It's some form of evil. Something bad is happening. Which means that the more Yisurim here, the more good things happen on the other end. It's a cosmic balance, a balance equilibrium, I call it.
Mm.
In my world, it exists.
Mm-hmm.
But if I want to get something positive out of this sentence, that's how I see it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you understand that your own Yisurim,
mm-hmm.
Whether you know it or not, creates a whole new balance on the other side mm-hmm. of good that's happening somewhere else, then you can rejoice. Not rejoice, but at least know that there's something positive happening.
If that is Jewish.
No, it's not a Jewish thing.
Well,
it's a very
let's talk about it like this.
It's more
let's
like
say that exists.
Duality thing.
let's say that that exists in the Jewish world of possibility, that there's sidedness of sufferings and joys, or sufferings and goodness that's created in the world, right? Moshe Del talks about having strands of early Kabbalah, which is capital K, Middle Ages mysticism, but early strands of mystical ideas within texts, right? And understanding that on the one hand we know that Yisroel exists, and on the other hand we don't wish for Yisroel to continue, and the world needs to be created, redeemed. This is an idea that out of that kind of turmoil comes redemption, that appears in the 11th chapter of Sanhedrin, vis-a-vis the Messianic Age, already, which we studied some of together, Perikah Chelek. And that is that with Chevle Mashiach and sufferings that will go on down below, that's one possibility in the realm of brightness we had about all the possibilities of what creates and begets the goodness that you're talking about. So it's in that vein that that dualism exists, which is not a true dualism, because all that exists within, as the prophet says, that all good and evil are created by the one true God. Remember that in the Siddur, we said that God was Yotzeret HaKol in the morning blessing before the Shema? Yotzer Or Vorech Hoshech Osei Shalom Voreet HaKol. Excuse me. Right? Creates the light, the darkness, right? And creates everything, except that's a restatement of a verse from Nevi'im, from the prophets, that said, not Yotzer HaKol, not Voreet HaKol, but Voreet Et HaTov Et HaRa, that creates, that God who creates the good and the evil. So within the context of oneness of God, we have the good and the evil beside one another on an active level. And in order to get to redemption, we can have suffering. But they're not dual powers battling with each other. So that is the idea that's not Jewish, right? That idea exists in other traditions, but not in ours.
I didn't say battle, I said equilibrium.
No. I wasn't suggesting, you were saying that there were two powers. I am explaining more, I think, widely how those exist within the concept of a redemption and a hope for a redemption, which is even beyond the Tov that you were referring to. I'm not sure.
The problem is that redemption assumes that once we're redeemed and the Messiah will come, Yemot HaMashiach, there will be no evil. It will be all harmony.
Maybe.
Well,
we saw pictures of that.
While what I'm talking about is a constant, forever, eternal process. It's not,
yes.
There's no redemption. It's always this and that.
And redemption by us is not as simple as everything is good forever.
It's not exactly Yemot HaMashiach.
Yeah. Not the days of Messiah are not exactly the days of Messiah.
So I have a question. So if this is such a good stuff, maybe Yeshua la Olam, why the Chachamim didn't make it a mitzvah?
Oh, for what?
Maybe Yeshua la Olam.
Yeah, let's suffer.
You mean to suffer? A mitzvah to suffer?
There is a mitzvah v'samachta b'chagecha. So why not to use suffering and make it a mitzvah to suffer so you can maybe Yeshua la Olam?
Did you ever see somebody who's really connected to Jewish law?
If it's such a good stuff to the world, why not to make a mitzvah?
I mean, I think, Bron, if you really ask some people who are connected to living out every...
I know at least two people that like to suffer all the time.
I'm telling you that there are some people who take that as a very serious mitzvah.
Very serious.
Them,
by the way, one of them are very Orthodox.
No joke. I think that if you look at some of the practices, and whether it's fasts or whether it's Tisha B'Av or whether it's... There are some days where you could pretty much define it as entering into Yisurin. All right, let's push forward into some other material. I want you to see a timely kind of thing that goes along with the Parsha. Turn to 9a2.
9a2.
Okay, so the left-hand side, you know, talking about on the, you know, maybe not equal, but opposite. For whom does rain come? So there's going to be a scriptural source. Matar bishvil yachid, on the left-hand side of 9a2. I'm about the middle of the page in Surah Adaf, if you're following along. So it's about the middle of the page. And Amar Rabbi Yochanan, exactly. Okay? You see that? But I'm kind of, I think I'm above. Matar Bishvil Yachid.
Below.
Yeah. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, I'm sorry. It's right there. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Matar Bishvil Yachid. Parnasa Bishvil Rabim. That rain comes for an individual. Wealth and prosperity because of the behavior of the many. Matar bishvil yachid. So does rain come for an individual? Dichtiv, yes, here I'm going to prove it to you. Yiftach Hashem l'chad et otzro hatov l'tate matar tzicha parnasa bishvil rabin. So he says, forget the parnasa for a second. The verse that proves that rain comes for one person. God will open the good storehouse for you to provide your land's rain. So since what? Yiftach Hashem lecha. It says in the singular that God will open it for you, that you, the individual, can be the cause of God letting the rain come. Parnasa bishvil rabim, dichtiv, and parnasa on behalf of many, Hineni mamtir lechem lechem. Lechem is plural. For you I will rain down the bread. And this describes the recipients of the manna in the plural.
We got this word bishvil being translated different ways in different sections we're reading. Does it mean for the sake of, or does it mean through the agency of? Because before it was bishvil meaning as a result, in other words, because of what the good people were doing.
Yeah.
Here we're saying
bishvil isn't even translated over here, by the way. Matar bishvil yachid. Rain is provided for one person.
Four.
What is four? It's not even a translation. It's neither for the sake of, or for the merit in the merit of, or what is the other potential you just offered?
Well, no, I mean, that's the same difference.
So bishvil is a really interesting word that way, because you can't really say it's lizchutam shel. You can't say it's for the merit of the follower, how these people merited for
us. But in the English,
for,
all I'm saying is that they're doing it, but it's not the same. It's inconsistent.
It's really not. So if you really think about the word bishvil, it's kind of one of those Hebrew service words that doesn't really mean exactly in their merit, and
it's avur.
And it's really avur. You know, because of this, then this happens. It's in the path of, use the word itself, right? Bishvil ze. If they follow this path, if they do this kind of thing, then this is going to happen. The point is that one person is being held up as the real reason why we would receive rain in the world. That one person could then what? Outweigh everybody's bad deeds, right? Right? That notion that high holidays that you hear sometimes. One, in the merit of one person.
No, but that's my point. Is
could the world
Steinhaus is interpreting it very differently. He's saying it's for the sake of an individual.
Yeah, and so if it's for the sake of, then it means to sustain that one person as opposed to in the merit of that one person, right? Yeah.
But then the beneficiaries, though, are different.
Right.
Because in the one case it's the single person, but the other one his efforts are benefiting.
Right.
The community.
Right. So you have to be careful about how you translate. See what you think it's really saying. Because the objection says the following. Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda says, "Shlosha parnasim tovim amdu l'Yisrael." No, there were three excellent leaders who really arose in Yisrael. Meaning, how is that an answer at all to what we just learned? You just told me that it was one excellent leader who could merit on behalf of the people all the rain that they need. But now the bright is going to come and it's going to say, no, but there were three excellent leaders. at this point, anyway, of the Brita, right? Because that's how I have to understand it. If it's being, if it's bringing a challenge, and Meitve is a word, a technical term in the Gemara that says, no, I have a Brita, which is a very good source, that kind of challenges your read and understanding of who really merits for the world the rain that we need, or for the land and the people. Eluhen. Here are the three who really are known as the right leadership that merited for us what does it say over there in the Steinsaltz, by the way?
At exactly which point?
Three excellent leaders arose for Israel.
Three good sustainers rose up for the Jewish people during the Exodus from Egypt, and they are Moses.
Okay, they are. Okay, Eluhen. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. They are Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So I thought, while we're reading the Parshiot, we should... Totally family business. And, of course, here, you could say that here's the nice group, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. She, in this small statement, is not known either as the sister of... or...
Moshe,
right? She's not known as Sister of, and she's not differentiated from rabbi to prophetess. The three of them rose. The three of them. Moses, Miriam, and Aaron.
By the way, who was born first? Miriam or Aaron?
Yeah, I always wondered about that.
Do you have those at Rockefeller, the records? I always wonder myself.
It doesn't say for sure?
Not clear.
Not really clear. Not really clear. I mean, it seems like she acts like the firstborn.
Right. She took control of it.
Yeah, and the Midrash wants to explain that she really convinces her parents to have Moses after Pharaoh's decree, right? So.
So we think.
And we don't hear from Aaron trying to save him.
Yeah.
So
to me, it seems like she's always been the firstborn.
But we can think of her as being, at least 10 years older than Moses, right? For what she's doing.
Well, we see her like that because she's already functioning in this role according to the way we understand our textual heritage.
But Pharaoh wanted to kill the firstborn, and Moses wasn't the firstborn, so he wasn't in danger to start with.
Born now, right?
He was the firstborn after they got back together and remarried.
The second or the third or the fourth. I mean, so something is wrong when they're all in the...
That's what the Midrash says. The Midrash says they split. Right? Yocheved and Amram. Moses' parents. Yeah. When the decree came, they get divorced. And after that, she, Miriam, goes to her parents and says, "You're worse than Pharaoh. You're condemning all boys and girls to not be born, to have no life." So, tradition says, they get back together, and Moses becomes the firstborn of that new union. Now, can they get re-wed according to halacha? You could make all kinds of, questions on whether or not this midrash has any validity, and there was no pit, and there was... No weasel.
I promise.
Because it was
Aaron is younger than Moses.
No older.
But they could have been Moses.
Right. Anyway, continuing along in this great triad of leaders, v'shalosh matanot tovot nitnu al yadam. Three great gifts were bestowed upon Israel in the merit of these three. Ve'eluhein, Be'er, Ve'anan, Uman. They are the well, the pillar of cloud, and the manna. Be'er b'zechut Miriam. Miriam merited for us the well, that traveling well in the desert that always provided us water at any time we needed. Now, my take on Moses and Miriam as the water providers, right? I've said this from the Bima. My take is, in the memory of Yisrael, they're astounded at how incredible these two are as desert guides who know the topography, who know the geography, right? That favorite of mine that is now discovered a year and a half ago, 2 years ago already, maybe three. The great professor at Bar-Ilan, who's writing about the topography and geography of the Negev and the Sinai, and how it could have been that hitting a rock releases all the water from the stratified limestone of the ancient pockets of water buildup at the time that the nomads are rolling through the desert. And literally he knows how to break which capstones, and there are capstones of this line, of this deposit, and that at least from there there's some water that can wet the palate and can be used.
Malbim said that in the 19th century.
Well, the Malbim,
this guy may be
Malbim says, this guy goes out and really finds the supports for how these caps work and how these spaces of stone work and the layers in the limestone stratified rock. Anyway, to me, some of that probably is here, but there's also an understanding of the fact that it's the magical well and that it follows them and that it provides water wherever they stop. And it's the miracle of it all. In her merit. Amud Anan b'zechut Aharon, the pillar of cloud in the merit of Aharon, and Man b'zechut Moshe, and the manna in the merit of Moses. Meita Miriam nistalek haba'er. Miriam died, the well was no more, disappeared. Shenemar v'tamot sham Miriam, and Miriam died there. Uchativ Batrei, immediately after it, it says, Lo haya mayim la'idah. And there wasn't water for the entire community to drink. V'chazra b'zechut shnehen, the well returned in the merit of the other two. Ma Aharon istalku anane chavod. But when Aaron died, the clouds of glory disappeared. Shneemar, v'yishma ha'knani melech Haran. And the Canaanite, the king of Arad, heard, and he fought against Israel. Ma shmua shama, what report did he hear that prompted him to attack Israel? Shama shemet Aharon. He heard that Aaron had died, and he was going to act on that opportune moment. Benistalku anane chavod, and that the clouds of glory had disappeared. Uchesavor nitna lo reshut lehilachem b'Yisrael, and he thought he was free to wage war against Israel. V'hainu dichtiv, and this is borne out by what's written, v'yiru kol aida kol gav Aharon, and all the community saw that Aaron had passed away. Gemara interjects to explain the relevance of the last mentioned verse. Amar Rav Abahu, al tikre vayiru. Don't read this as they saw Ela vayirau, and they appeared. Thus the verse is understood, and all the community appeared, and were no longer enveloped by the clouds of glory. In other words, they were sitting ducks. Kiddarish Reish Lakish, this is expounded by Reish Lakish, Damar Reish Lakish, ki mishamish ba'arba l'shonot, the word ki may be used in four senses. In other words, he's learning it out of a little technical piece of the text itself. But, yeah, let's get down to where the Braita continues. Hazru shnehem b'zechut Moshe. But in the merit of Moses, the singular Moses, both of them returned, that is, the well returned and the clouds of glory. When Moses died, though, Moshe nistalku kulan. Moses died, they all disappeared. So what do we learn from the end of this? That one person can ultimately bring about the great miracles that you thought three people needed to be alive for. But it's a different proof text than the proof text we had earlier that used the singular, God will open for you, the you, lecha, being in the singular. It's using the Moses, Miriam, and Aaron story to really help us understand it. Now, when Moses died, Kulan, they all disappeared. Chinamara, the Achid et Shloshet Aruim beYerach Echad. I removed the three shepherds in 1 month. V'chi beYerach Echad meitu? But did they really die in 1 month? Is that what you're telling me? V'halo Miriam meita beNisan. Miriam died in Nisan. V'Aaron ba'Av. Aaron in the month of Av. Moshe ba'Adar. And here are traditions of where we have their deaths. Shenit bat gimel matanot shlosh matanot tovot shenit nu al yadan, that the three gifts that were bestowed on Israel because of them were nullified. V'nistalku kulan beYerach Echad, and they disappeared all in the same month, the month in which Moses died. So maybe that they died in different times, But the gifts all went away, kind of all at once. Meanwhile, the Gemara shows, Alma Ashkechan Parnasa Bishvil Yachid. We find that prosperity is granted for the sake of an individual. The manna was provided in the merit of Moses alone. And this is going to contradict Rabbi Yochanan's statement earlier on that prosperity is not provided for only one. Well, Shanei Moshe. But shouldn't we say that Moshe is different from other people? I mean, for his merit, we could rely on one person. Kevan de la Rabim Hubai, since he prays on behalf of the many. Kerabim Dami, he is as many people. He's a plural guy.
Singular plural.
So, just to say that, as a kind of capper to the notion of the discussion of, you know, in whose merit the world goes on, what is it that one has to, quote-unquote, suffer, if we are to take that statement about suffering where we were before and we left it as pains and pangs and suris, what I would say is that the Gemara internally was helping us deal with that statement to get away from the Christological understanding and move us towards what it really means to take on the problems of our community and our society. And that is, they put it in all now in the notion of the model that we have of Moses, who's the last man standing, if you will. And what is he doing really on behalf of everyone? He's praying. And where did we ultimately start the whole Masechta? We're praying. And what's really all this about?
Power of prayer.
The power of prayer. Being a mensch, sticking to your word, and the power of prayer. And sticking to your word part, if we're going to be a Baal Amana, if we're going to be faithful to our word, back to the point we made before, we'll also expect God, you, to be Baal Amana. You to be good to your and true to your word. And if not, we'll even take our prayer deeper, and thus we will get to next time around that we're able to start our learning back up together, Mishnayot, about how we really convince God through even more powerful prayer to make good on the word of the divine and move our community into this notion of taking collective responsibility, one individual for the community, but all individuals in the community really being responsible for each other. So I'll tell you what's going on for students.